Wake up call.
This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. We continue hour number two as we roll along this morning. And the Combine is rolling along. Maybe you're into that, maybe you're not, but it's an important tool that NFL teams use to figure out who they want to pick, and how they are going to evaluate talent. It's been overly criticized for years and years about exactly what goes on at the Combine and what can you actually gain by watching players do 40-yard shuffles and three-cone drills and 40-yard dashes, but you are getting some of the basic knowledge of these players. You're getting their size, their weight, what they look like, their build, etc. The underwear Olympics, as it's been called. Is it important? Yeah, it's important. Your stock could rise or fall based on your performance at the Combine. I think one thing that is underlooked when it comes to evaluating talent is how players do in interviews. There's a level of confidence that you want to see, but not cocky. But there also is, they're evaluating how you answer questions and whatnot. Now, sometimes the questions can get a little evasive and they can get a little personal. And we every now and then, there is somebody that asks a prospect a question that is out of bounds. And we've had that before. But overall, it's news. One other thing about the Combine is it's the one place where all the general managers are going to be, right? And everybody knows that they're all there to work. So when you go to the Combine as a reporter, it's an opportunity to ask general managers, team presidents, et cetera, about the current state. The Tennessee Titans, for example, have a brand new general manager. John Robinson was fired mid to late season. And Rand Carthon has now taken over the team. Now, Rand Carthon was there with the Tennessee Titans brass, and he was asked about Ryan Tannehill. And he said with confidence that Ryan Tannehill is going to be the quarterback of the Titans in 2023. There's a lot of speculation on where the Titans were going to go with quarterback. Tannehill was injured and the team struggled. And there's an idea that, you know, in the AFC, you try to get an elite signal caller. And there may be an opportunity to do that if you can position yourself with maybe some trades in this draft. But they're committing to Ryan Tannehill. Do I take that as gospel? Not really. Anything can change at any minute, and you don't know what deal you're going to play. This is how GMs play this. They go into these combine situations where they know they're not just going to get asked about the players that are on the board and how they evaluate and what they're looking for. They're going to be asked about the team, right? Rand Carthon was asked, for example, about the cuts that they made a week ago with Taylor Lewan and a number of Zach Cunningham and a number of their other players. But you can spin anything you want. So Ryan Tannehill being the way the Titans are committed at quarterback is good today and likely will be, I mean, unless something comes their way. But they also could be shopping around. You have to say it today so that you present yourself as a team that other teams may want to talk to, but you're not playing your hand. That's the whole game. You never want to come in desperate. You never want to come in saying, yeah, we're thinking about looking for a quarterback, so anybody wants a veteran like Ryan Tannehill, give us a call. Because you've opened the door for people to go, hey, I'm inquiring about Tannehill, and I know you want to get rid of him. Think about that as a bargaining situation. So I'm always cautious with these statements. I know there are people who take it as word. This is where the Titans are going. But I know that things can change. If a conversation happens where a team says, you know what, we're not in a position to draft a rookie quarterback and we don't really want a rookie quarterback. We want a good signal caller that can take this team for the next 2 years while we figure out other things. We're interested. What can you get us get, you know, what would you take for them? They would answer that phone call and they would be in a discussion. I really do. I think so. But the Titans are not in a position to get one of the top four picks in the quarterback in the first round. So they would have to figure out if Malik Willis is their answer, or in other cases, where do you go after you get rid of a veteran who has done well for you like Ryan Tannehill? Those are the kind of things that occur at the Combine. But a lot of people are focused on, let's say, the 40-yard dash, right? Everybody's focused on some of the other drills. Me, I am focused on the quarterbacks. I am focused on basically four guys that are going to be the big names going into the first round. And that is going to be Will Levis of Kentucky, Bryce Young of Alabama, C.J. Stroud of Ohio State, and Florida's Anthony Richardson. I don't know what order that'll be. I don't know what order it'll look like until this week is over and I start seeing where the buzz is. But again, I go back to something that we talked about pre-combine, which is so much of the focus is going to be on the Chicago Bears and what they do with that number one pick. What do they want? Their biggest need is going to be on the defensive side. But they also need an offensive lineman. You're in the number one pick. How do you evaluate that number one pick? You can get anybody you want, so you can fill the need with anybody you want on the board and let everybody else vie for positioning behind the Houston Texans, who are likely going to take a quarterback with that number two pick. Or you're in a position of looking down the line and saying, here are the Indianapolis Colts at four. Now, their biggest need is at quarterback. The number three team on the board is Arizona. Their biggest need is not quarterback, as they have just signed, Kyler Murray to a big deal before the season started last year. And I know Murray was hurt, but nevertheless, they're not looking in another direction. They have a new coach, but they're not looking in another direction. So if you're the Colts, how do you look at the quarterback situation? That's going to be the big key. One, are you okay with Bryce Young, C.J. Stroud, Will Levis, and Anthony Richardson? Are you okay with all four of them? Right? That's what's going to be coming out of the combine. Are you okay with all four of them? Are you okay with getting whoever you want after the Houston Texans take a quarterback? But what if a team behind you that needs looking for a quarterback or is in need of a quarterback moves up? Let's say the Raiders over at seven, they make a deal with the Bears to jump up and take that number one pick. Now you're sitting at four. You'll have the Raiders that'll take a quarterback. You'll have the Texans that'll take a quarterback. Now the question is, if you're the Colts at four, are you okay with the third quarterback that's on the list? Now, how you evaluate and how the team's evaluated are going to be different things, but are you okay with who's left over after two quarterbacks are off the table? If you're the Colts, how solid of a position are you at number four? Do you want to get ahead of Houston and be the number one team that takes the number one quarterback off the board? But again, are you okay with sitting put, not giving up assets, and getting whoever falls into your lap? And I think that's an interesting dynamic. And I'm the Bears. I don't know what I would do here. It's a really difficult situation to evaluate. One, you're a team that hasn't picked number one overall since the 40s. And that's a special place to be. It's not a good place to be in that your record allows you to be the worst team in the NFL. But when you push that in the past, it's an exciting place to be in terms of your future. You get to take the top talent in this draft. You get to pick the number one guy off the board. You could pick a franchise quarterback if you don't believe Justin Fields is your franchise quarterback after one season as a starter and two seasons in the league. I think it's too small of a sample to evaluate his importance to the Bears going forward. But there isn't an eye-popping Andrew Luck in this draft either. So if you're the Bears, you're kind of okay by saying, look, we're not in a position to draft a Peyton Manning. We're not in a position to draft an Andrew Luck. We're not in a position to draft a Trevor Lawrence. We're not forced with the decision of getting a franchise-level player, a guy with the size, arm, accuracy, all the check boxes. We're not in a position to do that. Maybe some of these guys wow us, but we have a quarterback we believed was that guy a couple of years ago. But we now want to hear what everybody else is saying. We want to pay attention to whatever else anybody else is talking about when it comes to quarterbacks, because as I mentioned before, if you're the Colts, you may make that phone call. If you're the Raiders, you may make that phone call. Because you know that if Houston takes the guy you want off the board, you're going to have to make a decision of whether or not the guy that's two or three is good enough to take as a top pick your quarterback going forward. And I'm wondering if you fall in love with a player, it makes you do kind of crazy things. If you're the Colts and you are in love with a player that you know the Texans won't take, how concerned are you that somebody, let's say the Colts fall in love with Anthony Richardson. Let's say they really believe that Anthony Richardson is a guy that they can mold into a really, really good NFL quarterback. But they're getting the sense that other teams aren't feeling that way. Now, I hate to do this because we know how people are when you make comparisons. They go crazy. So I'm not comparing Anthony Richardson to this comparison. I'm not making a comparison player to player, but I'm saying circumstances. That's how the Kansas City Chiefs got Patrick Mahomes.
Are you crazy? You can't make that comparison.
I knew it. But that's exactly what the Chiefs did. Remember? The Chiefs went, hold on. There's a kid here that we really like.
And what did everyone say? That was a reach.
That was a reach. We're going to go get him. Nobody else is talking about him.
Could have got him in the second round, Kansas City.
Exactly.
Third
C
round.
Plus grade, Mel Kiper. So that's what happened.
Again, I think he's done okay.
Yeah, he's done all right. It worked out. Now, again, I'm not comparing player to player. Don't go nuts on me here. But what I'm saying is that's what the Colts are hoping would happen if they said, you know, we like Anthony Richardson. Does anybody else? Are we getting the buzz that the Texans like him? All right, maybe they like C.J. Stroud. Everybody likes C.J. Stroud. Or they like Bryce Young. Everybody likes Bryce Young. What about anybody else that may pop up ahead, like really make a deal with the Bears? Like I said, the Raiders at 7. Anybody else? Do they like him too? Okay, no. Let's stay here. Let's get him. And then they get him. Let's see what happens. That's what also can play out. The Combine can open eyes to a lot of players. There's always a player that emerges as the star of the Combine, and we all kind of, at the end of April, we go, oh, let's wait up. Let's wait and see this out. I'm wondering who that's going to be. Good, the bad, and the dumb is coming up next. We haven't had it for a few days. I'm excited to hear about it. And then later on, more controversial issues around Alabama and Brandon Miller. We'll get to that story coming up in this hour as we roll along on Sports Map Radio. Glad to be with us on Wednesday.
Wake Up Call continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Time for the good.
That's really nice.
The bad.
That's the bad guy.
And the dumb.
What an idiot. Oh, what a loser.
All right, the good, the bad, and the dumb. Like I said, we had 2 days off earlier this week, so we are back. It's loaded with good, bad, and dumb. Let's get to the good of the day.
Okay. I might be in the minority here.
Go ahead.
And in fact, I feel like I'm going to be, and I could get some hate mail.
Oh, I like this.
Right, but I'm a fan of the pitch clock.
I am too.
There was a video that just kept appearing on my timeline. And it was Jose Altuve running the bases on an inside the park home run. Right?
Right.
In the past, not during spring training. And the whole thing was, how many times can he make it around in real-time video? They didn't speed this up. How many times can he make it around before Javi Baez throws a pitch? Was it Javi Baez? No, Javier. Somebody. Throws a pitch to David Ross during the 2016 World Series.
Mm.
And Jose Altuve made it around, I think it was 4 times.
See, that's what I like about it. Yeah. They're talking about how just in spring training, they're getting a small metric. You know, so there will obviously be different. You know, they're hoping it's going to be the same in the regular season, but they're saying games are way down in terms of.
Why does that? You know, everyone's like, I've heard some people complain, like, who wants a 2-hour game? And I'm like, yeah. I do. I mean, I do. God, you know, these 4-hour marathon baseball games that are 1-0, and it hasn't been defensively, you know, a defensive game. It was just because, you know, pitchers were taking their time and, you know, the batters are taking their time. And it's like that got out of control.
Yeah. When I was younger and I was starting, when I really wanted to know I wanted to do this for a living, I kind of had a dream, like a lot of people, of being a baseball announcer, right? I loved baseball and I kind of wanted to do it. And as I got older, I realized I didn't want to do baseball at all. When I had tried it, I just couldn't do it. I'm a fast talker. I kind of like action. And I didn't have all the stories that you need to fill time. And I just didn't want to spend my time trying to find more stories to tell in between pitches.
Yeah.
I just didn't do it. I didn't have the scullyness of a timeless story that I could. I just did not like the dead time in baseball. And there was plenty of it. Now it's like you can do this because the game is going to speed up a little bit. It's going to give you some pop, some action. I'm good, man. I like it.
I'm not seeing anything wrong with it. That's the problem, right?
Yeah. Now, would you allow
Would you allow the World Series, the pitch clock to be extended? So that the World Series, like pitchers who come in like, all right, this is World Series. Or would you say, no, it's the rules. We don't do the shot clock differently in the NBA.
Yeah, no, I think by that time you're kind of used to it.
Yeah.
I would hate, though, for a World Series to end on a strike call.
I hope that doesn't happen.
Because the batter didn't come into the box.
I hope there's some adjustment to that, but it's a rule, right? A rule should be punished if it's – you can't just say it's a rule, but if you do it, if you don't do it, we won't do anything.
I want it to be treated the same way like goalies in soccer. You know, the rule is that you can only – like a goalie can only hold on to the ball for about 8-10 seconds.
Right.
Then he has to get rid of it. And you see that bent all the time, but it's up to the discretion of the ref. You know, maybe there's something going on, you know. If it doesn't look like he's stalling for time, you know, then I think you let it play on.
Yeah, you could give a little bit of a warning in those
situations.
But,
I mean, you know,
the box, or I'm going to call this.
I know, you know baseball players are superstitious. I can't stand why a batter will go into the box, take a ball, they could take a called ball pitch, step out of the box, and readjust everything.
I know. Nomar Garciaparra was famous for that.
Yeah.
15, 20 different steps before you get back in.
I know. And it's just like, I'm like, okay, I get it. You're superstitious. But, you know, did you just do one thing that led to another thing? You're like, well, I got to combine these two. Now I got to combine these three. Well, I got to do these four. It's like, that's you're getting to the point of ridiculous now.
The NBA does it on the free throw line. You can't sit at the free throw line forever.
Yeah.
You can't stand there and do, oh, no, hold on. I got a 20-second routine of doing these 15 different things. You go, no, you have a certain amount of time. When I give you the ball, you got to shoot that free throw. You can do whatever you want until that time, but you got to shoot that free throw. You can't be there forever.
I mean, tennis players, you know, Rafael Nadal has a whole routine that he does, and it's the same exact routine all the time, but he's, like, shortened it to, like, he can complete his routine in, like, 5-6 seconds.
Yep. They give warnings out to golfers on the PGA Tour. You better get moving. Like we're not kidding around. Like, you can't spend 15 minutes lining up your shot. So, yeah, good. I'm a fan of it, too. I'm interested to see time games. I know you are, too. I like throwing baseball games on, like, in the summertime.
Yeah.
Like, I watch a lot of Braves games here. I like throwing the Braves on. I just sometimes I'll be done with my stuff, and I'll be like, it's still the seventh inning. And I'm ready to go. Like,
right.
You know, it's like, well,
you know, and then what's worse, though, is that when you've had the game on, you think a whole lot of time's elapsed. You look at the TV, and it's like, this game's only in the fourth?
Yeah, I know.
Hasn't it been 3 hours already? Exactly. And that's the problem that I have, was that, you know, I like baseball, but there is a moment where you do reach that point of ridiculousness where it's just, you know, the pitchers doing all these different things. I mean, this one video, like, really, like, summed it up perfectly. Jose Altuve literally ran around all four bases, or, you know, all that time, about four times before the pitch was thrown.
God, that's crazy. Crazy. All right, what's the bad of the day?
Bad of the day. Louisville's basketball season.
Yeah, it was terrible.
It's terrible. They have four wins on the season, but this is a bad kind of mixed with a little bit of good. Maybe it's poetic justice. I don't know. Uh-huh. But during their final home game, which I believe was against Syracuse, there was a really funny moment that kind of summed up their season. They had a frisbee-catching dog on the court.
Oh, nice, yeah.
Who paused his routine to take a dump on the court.
Oh, come on. Really?
So a lot of people are pointing out, like, sums up the season right there.
Come on.
He was doing his routine. Then he started, he squatted down like he was doing. The trainer could not run out there fast enough because a little something something was left behind before frisbee catching dog could be carried off the court.
Like, why, if you're in charge of that, why aren't you not making sure the dog is relieved? Isn't there a way to do that?
Tony, sometimes you just gotta go.
Yeah, but I mean, when you train dogs and you're a show dog, like, they don't worry about that at the Westminster Dog Show. There's an eating schedule and they kind of have that down. Know your dog's time.
Yeah.
Train the dog not to go whenever it
or maybe
wants.
He was paid to do that. Like, you know, hey, maybe we need something to sum up this season.
Maybe so.
Have the dog do it on the floor, on the court.
You are totally right. The Cardinals.
There's poetry. in
yeah,
that.
That might be so.
But yeah, 4-26. I mean, that's not the Louisville basketball we know.
No, it isn't. I mean, again, it's been a while since they won that championship that kind of got vacated back in 2013, and they are long removed from the Rick Pitino era that ended in, what, 2017? But Chris Mack is gone, and then I think – I can't remember the name of the guy that's the head coach now. I think it's Kenny Payne, if I'm not mistaken. I'll have to look it up. But they're not – no, they stink. They're pretty bad. So, all right, what's the dumb of the dumb of the day?
Dumb of the day is right up your alley, especially most recently up your alley. But
yes, we
need to know the name Jeff Wrights.
Jeff Wrights. Okay.
Yes, because he is officially awarded a Guinness World Record yesterday for visiting Disneyland nearly 3,000 consecutive days.
Yeah, that's like what, 8 years?
Yeah, he went 2,995 consecutive days and was only derailed because of the closing of Disneyland during COVID.
So maybe they can give him a buzz. Like maybe they could reword it that is as long as it was open, he went.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, well, I don't know if he stopped.
Oh, did he stop?
He might have stopped like after COVID.
Year.
Yeah, COVID
they
was
close that park down for
just about
not a year.
Just about.
So
yeah.
They opened the one in Florida sooner. Then they want the one in Anaheim, but
yep. Man, yeah. I know that they're making it harder and more expensive to get into Disneyland. I think that's to recoup the money that they lost.
Yeah, no kidding.
But no, I mean, I don't know, 3,000 straight times. That's a lot of Disney.
There was I heard of. I shouldn't say no because I don't know him, but I heard of there was a lawyer who lived in Southern California, and he had a quote unquote office where he would take his work to Disneyland every day, and he had a bench near one of the rides, and that's where he did his office work. He would just go in there and just, that's what I like. I just like people watching, and I like just sitting at this table, and I get a little drink and stuff, and I do my work on my computer, and I'm good.
That sounds kind of fun.
Yeah, sounds like fun. It's like I didn't want to do, if I'm going to do work on the laptop in an office, a stuffy office, this was like no clients, no nothing, just paperwork. He's like, I just went to Disneyland. He's like, that's where I'm going to do the paperwork. So I'm like, just instead of typing on a laptop and on a desk, why don't I do it at a nice table back when the crowds were manageable? And he's like, I'm not doing it. I just go there, enjoy the music, the fun.
Yeah. We'll
get a snack and do my paperwork there.
That's where
he had his office hours.
I think I would get sick of it, but I could have a corn dog every day.
Yeah, why not?
Because those corn dogs, there's like a little bit of crack in those corn dogs, I think.
That's very true. I agree completely. All right, that's the good, the bad, and the dumb as we continue. It's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Call. SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That is Ron with two N's. If you missed the show, you can also subscribe to the podcast. We'd love it if you did. You can go to podcastarena.com. You can just search Wake Up Call, Tony D and Ron Culver. You could find it. Subscribe to it. We'd love you to be part of what we're doing here on SportsMap Radio. So for two decades, we had the New England Patriots being the dominating force of NFL. If they weren't in the Super Bowl, you kind of wanted to know where they didn't make the Super Bowl, right? Who beat them en route to that, because they were always in the playoffs, felt like they were always in the AFC title game. So whenever you would see a Pittsburgh or a Denver or Baltimore playing for the championship, the Colts back in the day, you'd kind of wonder, well, what happened to New England? What happened to them? And in 1 year, Tom Brady didn't play because he got hurt in week one. They didn't make the playoffs in Brady's second year after winning the Super Bowl. They got beat by a number of different teams occasionally. Steelers never beat them, for example, but Denver did. Denver did it a couple of times, one without Peyton Manning and a couple times with Peyton Manning. But they sort of established this presence in Boston as sort of the title city of America, right? And it was sort of trickled down a little bit. Right, the Red Sox won the 2004 World Series while the Patriots were winning Super Bowls. They would win the World Series again in 2007, 2013, 2018. The Celtics won the 2008 NBA Finals. They played in the NBA Finals in 2010. They were back in the NBA Finals last year. The Bruins won a Stanley Cup in, I think, 2011, right? And now the Patriots are a team that's fighting to get into the playoffs if they get in at all. They're struggling with Mac Jones at quarterback. The dynasty is over. But it doesn't mean the city of Boston is over. That fan base for the last 25 years, you can go back to, let's call it about 25 years, has always celebrated something. Not necessarily a title, but their team being in a position to win a title. And they are again this year. Now, the Celtics, you may know, are leading the Eastern Conference, but they're tied right now with the Milwaukee Bucks. The Bucks have won 15 straight games, and now they are really cooking. They had gotten Chris Middleton back in the lineup a while back. While Giannis has been in and out, nevertheless, the team consistently finds ways to win games. They have done so for 15 straight. They have caught Boston. Both teams are now tied for the division lead. They had a game. The Celtics had a game on Monday against the Knicks. Jaylen Brown didn't play. Jason Tatum got ejected. They'll be full strength tonight. Nevertheless, the Boston Bruins are the most successful team we have in all of sports right now. An absolute juggernaut in the NHL. I mean, some of you follow the NHL. Some of you follow it better than I follow it. But the Bruins are almost an indestructible force of what's going on in the league. Now, if you know the NHL, you know you get 2 points every time you win. You get a point if you have an overtime loss. And it's mostly about the accumulation of points, whereas in the other sports, we kind of talk about the record. In the NHL, they talk about points. The Eastern Conference, the Bruins lead the Eastern Conference with 99 points. They are 47-8-5. So they have five overtime losses. They have played 60 games, 99 points. That is 13 points more than the Carolina Hurricanes in second place in the Eastern Conference. And better than that, they are 24 points better than what is going on in the Western Conference. I mean, it is an absolute machine. Their goal differential is near 100. They've won 8 straight games. They have the best home record in the NHL by a mile. They are 24-2-3. And oh, by the way, they're really good on the road too, at 23-6-2. They will outscore you, outwork you, and they're crushing everybody in the NHL. Now, I bring this up not to talk about hockey per se, but to talk about how a city in the United States can be really blessed with success. Now, I've had the privilege in this job of interviewing guys like Bob Ryan and Dan Shaughnessy, people like that, in every now and then to talk about Boston sports. And a lot of it had to do with the Patriots, but occasionally I would have an opportunity to talk to them when things were rolling. I remember I was filling in on this network once, and I had a scheduled segment with Bob Ryan during an NHL series where the Bruins were facing the Blackhawks. And they lost that series, but they were competing for the Stanley Cup. But it is not lost on a lot of New England fans on how blessed they have been in 20 years. But the one thing that I sort of ask is, if you're in the front office of the Red Sox or the Celtics, and you've got your own obstacles within your league, right? In, let's say, in baseball, you're trying to measure who you're going to get in free agency and how it's going to gel together and how much does the owner really want to spend and how much over the luxury tax do you want to go over? And in the Celtics, how much do you play within the salary cap? How do you build a team and win in an Eastern Conference that for a long time was dominated by LeBron James until he left for the Lakers, right? Bruins, same kind of thing. You're working in a cap environment. How do you get a free agent here? How do you work the draft here? You've got your own individual issues, but I always used to ask how much of the Patriot success, again, not even within your realm of business operation, just through osmosis, if you will, or just by the just having a feeling of winning, how much pressure was it on those executives in those other for those other sports to say, like, let's match that. Let's match it. And I was always given, in some theoretical way, that it did have a factor. That the Patriots having this sort of dynastic look to them did affect the way teams in the other sports under entirely different business models operated within those business models. And you really started to see success. Now, look, should we give credit to Bill Belichick and the Patriots for the Red Sox breaking a curse in 2004? No, but what it did say was you didn't want to be the team that was failing when the wave of good fortune was being bestowed upon your city. Especially if you noticed that it wasn't just one team. There was another team that was consistently in the postseason and consistently making runs for the playoffs and a championship, like the Red Sox were when they won the World Series in 2004 and then won it a couple of years later and then won it a couple of years later after that, right? That there is a sense that you don't want to be left behind, that you better figure this out. And it continues. And here's the funny thing. We always sort of give it to cities that catch a brief moment of this, right? For a brief period of time, Tampa Bay was the red-hot championship city, right? They had the Buccaneers win the Super Bowl, and the Lightning were winning the Cup, and the Rays were in the playoffs. Rays are actually in the World Series. And there was this period of time where it looked like Tampa was the city of champions. But they were only really borrowing it. Because it didn't have to be about the Patriots. It just had to be about Boston teams. And here was the funny thing about it. If you go against, even if you just looked at, hey, trying to win a championship, the list is incredible, right? It isn't so much about Tom Brady winning 6 Super Bowls for the New England Patriots. It's that they were in 9 of them. Now, the Red Sox won every World Series that they appeared in, but the Celtics had been competing for championships, and they lost a couple of finals. The one win in 2008. The Bruins, the same way. Like I mentioned earlier, losing in the finals to the Chicago Blackhawks a number of years ago. So there is a consistency within the city that they always seem to be vying for something at some time. In fact, you can't really, like, you can go from 2002 and you can almost find them fighting for a championship in every year, minus one or two, within a 20-year plan, 20-year place. And if it continues, if you find a summer, a June, in which the Bruins are competing for the Stanley Cup, which is likely, because it's really hard to beat a team in a 7-game series if that team is at full strength. So barring injury, which is always the X factor, it's going to be really hard for a team to get 4 out of 7 against this Bruins team that doesn't even lose back-to-back games. They barely lose back-to-back games. They had like a 3-game losing skid a couple of weeks ago. But I mean, it's like extremely rare that you'll find them on the lose, especially if you have to play them over and over again. And the Celtics, who may not get to the NBA Finals because the Sixers and the Milwaukee Bucks should give them a hard... I mean, it was a 7-game series last year with Milwaukee. But they're as good as any of those three in representing the East. If you find in June that the Celtics and the Bruins are both vying for championships within their sport, it's just one more that is added on to the amazing 2-decade-plus run that the city has had. And here's the funny thing about it. When a city gets that blessed, right, it builds animosity, and there's nobody more ready to block the arrows that come their way than the people of New England. And look, when I grew up there, I grew up in New Hampshire, it was the Celtics, and that was it. The Patriots, eh. A lot of kids were like me. Like I wasn't born in New England. I was born in New York, but I grew up in New England. I ended up liking the Steelers because they were the good team in the late 70s. I wasn't really interested in liking the Patriots because they weren't very good. Celtics, different thing. But same thing with the Red Sox. I mean, the Red Sox were all right, but meh. But it was always around, outside of the Celtics, they were always around this sort of long time coming, right? Like, oh, the Red Sox. We know about the Red Sox. Or the Patriots couldn't even envision. If you went around in the 80s and you said, look, I can project you 20 years into the future, right? 84, 85. So I'll project you 20 years in the future. Which team will be the dominating team in the NFL? You would have been hard-pressed, even if you saw a wide-open book, hard-pressed to pick the Patriots. Ownership issues, not really a great place to play, at the old Schaefer Stadium. Foxborough, where the heck is that? That kind of stuff. But now they're a city that constantly is putting a team into the presence of the American sports culture. It's really, really wild. Absolutely wild. Again, on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver, that is Ron with two N's. Celtics, again, I can see the Celtics not getting in the finals. I would be blown away if the Bruins can't get it. I'd be blown away. All right, it's Tony D, Ron Culver at Sports Map Radio.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, thanks for joining us as we continue on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. Patrick, speaking of NHL, we don't talk a lot of NHL, but there was a big trade yesterday. Patrick Kane of the Chicago Blackhawks, who's now 34 years old, has been traded to the New York Rangers. It's one of those situations where he was such a star that you kind of envision he always will be playing for the Chicago Blackhawks.
Yeah.
He won 3 Stanley Cups for them. He scored a goal. You may not remember this, but he scored a goal against the Philadelphia Flyers in the Stanley Cup Finals that won the cup. And it was this weird experience because I think the greatest hockey play-by-play announcer is of all time is Mike Emmerich, and he was calling the game. And I don't think even he knew it was a goal because it was so quick. The only person that knew it was a goal, not only a goal, a clinching, I won the cup goal, was Patrick Kane. Like, you didn't see it go in. It wasn't one of those moments where, like, it hit the back of the net and rah! Like, it was, it slipped in, and then he won it. And then he knew it. He knew that it had gone over, and he started celebrating the fact that the Blackhawks had won the cup. And I think his teammates just kind of went along with it. And then next thing you know, people are like, yep, it did. That was a goal. Yeah, it was an overtime goal that won it. He was the youngest player in NHL history to score a Stanley Cup winning goal. I mean, he was a kid, and he won it for the city. It was their first cup in a while. So Patrick Kane got traded to the Rangers. So that was the big move yesterday. So I was just talking about the Bruins earlier. That's why I felt like I had to bring up the news.
It was kind of a shock.
Yeah, it was.
You know, I mean, like you said, I mean, it's one of those. I thought he would just retire as a Blackhawk.
You kind of think that with certain athletes. There are just certain athletes that you think mm-hmm. the franchise will go, look, in the end, we're not going to trade you. You're the guy. But, you know, there are circumstances behind everything. Gretzky got traded because the Oilers wanted money and whatnot.
Well, I mean, and then that's, you know, it's no more evident of a case that sports is a business.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we may think it's all fun and games and, you know, our heroes play forever. But at the end of the day, you know, these guys look at the bottom line and go, oh, we need draft picks. We need this. We need to change this.
We're
we need
always looking two or three steps ahead all the time. So while I was away, whenever I'm on vacation, I try. My wife has this thing because a lot of people have jobs where when they go on vacation, they can leave their job, right? They don't have to think about their work. That, you know, but if you're in sales, for example, you may think about clients that you got to get a hold of while you're when you come back from vacation, or maybe there's a meeting that's coming up. But most of us try to get away. But I have this job where I have to follow sports. I don't want to come back completely isolated from and just get an ocean of sports news. So I try to pay attention to what's going on. But my wife really doesn't like it when I'm on the computer. She doesn't really like it when I watch TV in the hotel room. You know, she always wants to, let's go out and do something. But I did notice that the Brandon Miller controversy is not died down. And again, rightfully so a little bit here because of the circumstances behind it. But the patting down pregame ritual that they do when Brandon Miller is introduced, He has this thing where another player kind of pats him down. That continued, and given the, what the circumstances of what we knew about the situation in Alabama, the tragic death of a young woman via a shooting, and Miller delivering the gun in that shooting, although delivering it under the idea that he was giving a friend his weapon back, not his weapon back to defend himself, didn't touch the gun, was in the back seat. His teammate Darius Miles took it and didn't know what it was for, didn't know the circumstances, cleared by the Tuscaloosa police, not a suspect or not even connected. But still, the optics aren't that good. And this created another situation where, okay, here is the University of Alabama, who knew that he does this, not stepping in and saying, if we are not going to allow you to do that just because the optics just don't look good. I got a thing here, Ron. I honestly think Alabama, this story is going to follow this team all the way through to the national championship if they make it that far. And they are national championship good. They could win the whole thing. But I think this story is not going away. And that is the one thing you don't want.
I think it's going to follow them through the SEC tournament, and then it's going to follow them into the – I mean, especially when it gets to Final Four time, like March Madness, when the start of the NCAA tournament. Their first game, that's the national story.
This story, again, when you and I talked about this last week, I said – I'm not gonna be overreactionary to this. I know a lot of people are. They love the clicks. They love the hate. They wanted to hear it from Alabama fans when they went on Twitter and wherever delivering these rants. But I wanted to look at it as a young man and also in context of the death of a young mother. Is he directly related to this death? And the answer to me was no. He was delivering something that did not belong to him to a friend who asked him and sort of gave the impression that he was needing it for defense. Okay? Miller did not know what was going to happen. He did not know that there was this circumstance. There's people arguing that he angled his car, et cetera, et cetera. You want to go down the road, go down the road. But I'm going to lean towards what the investigation showed. So to me, I'm not outraged in this case for Miller. I'm sad for that young woman. I really am. But I'm also not going to make a there that I don't feel is there, right? I'm really not. I'm not going to do 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon here. Like, I'm not going to try to attach it and say Miller is just as culpable as the guy that pulled the trigger. I just don't find that link. Now, I'm one of those people. You may disagree. You may think that the guy should have been suspended, whatever. But I will make a case here. I said said last week that I think Nate Oates was in a no-win situation, and I still do. If he had suspended Brandon Miller, then you create a there, right? If he had said, look, you may not be guilty, you may not be charged, but in my team, in my structure, it's too close, it's too tied to a death of a young mother, I'm going to suspend you for 3 games. Now, superstar or not, that's what it is. Well, now people are going to wonder, what are you suspending him for? Now he has to answer that, right? He has to say why. And if you're the coach and you come out and you say, I'm suspending him because of the attachment of him to this tragic case that happened on campus, this tragic shooting that ended in the death of a young woman, you are naturally creating a tie between him and the shooting that is going to be filtered, that he is as guilty as the men who pulled the trigger. Right?
Yeah.
So you're Nate Oates. You know that.
Because that's how we do things, right?
Guilty
until proven innocent.
So, again, imagine if he's a step ahead of this story, suspends his superstar, he's asked about it, and the explanation is, he's too tied to this. He didn't pull the trigger, but he's too tied to this. Then the narrative and the way people are looking at it is Darius Miles says, hey, I gotta get my gun. I got to get back at this guy. You got to get me my gun. And he goes, yeah, I got you. I got you, brother. I got you. I'll give you your gun, and gets the gun. That's the story that gets created. So Nate Oates knows this, right? So Nate Oates goes, if I suspend him, I create something that's not there. As long as he's not been charged, why would I suspend him? Why would I go down the road? Even if you want to say it's about the integrity of your program, Well, what am I supposed to do? Like, am I supposed to attach my kids to crimes they didn't commit?
Yeah.
Am I just supposed to do that? But on the flip side, by not doing anything, he allows the people to sort of step up and say, Alabama's failing. Alabama doesn't understand the severity of this. Alabama doesn't understand that a young woman's life was taken. Alabama's treating this. The only thing they care about is winning. The only thing Nate Oates cares about is his legacy. His winning. Now, why? His superstar has to play. His superstar has to be out on the court. There's the other side. So he's in a no-win situation here. But he could have done this, right? He could have said, we need to stop that. Can we not do that? Nate Oates even said it was afterwards. I get it. It's a bad look. They've got to cut that out. They've got to cut that out. Look, is he mocking the investigation? No, that's his thing. He's done it since the beginning of the season. He did it before the shooting. It's a thing he does. So that wasn't done in a direct answer to the Tuscaloosa Police Department, right, who investigated him. It was a thing he does, whatever reason. But if you're Nate Oates, this can't be the thing that you are doing before every game during the SEC tournament and the NCAA tournament, right? Like, you've got to nip that in the bud at least, right? Let the people boo, make up their own minds. There's nothing you can do about it. People know the information. They're going to process it the way. It's like anything else. But this does have a really bad look that if I'm Alabama, I work on fixing. And maybe they already have, but I would absolutely work on fixing. All right, hour three coming up. Jared Dubin is going to join us. We're talking some NBA with him. We'll also talk more about that pitch clock that we had in the good, the bad, and the dumb.